have to introduce in the action you start from in a functional integral, for instance, to construct a quantum theory, you have to have what is called the counter term, which makes that the theory at the level of the regulator, the microscopic, the smallest scale at which you define the theory is not massless, but it's massless on large scales. So what we have been doing is that, so for instance, in fact, the rule of the game are the following. You want to define a theory so that a correlation function of some fields, phi of x1, phi of xn, you need to define a correlation function which are finite in the limit where the regulator goes to infinity, where lambda is an ultraviolet regulator. You introduce this regulator in order to make sense of the theory, and you want to get rid of this theory. Okay. So it may be something you plug in the theory in order to make sense of it. It may also be a physical regulator, which happens because what you are doing is that you are trying to construct a quantum theory which is valid beyond some energy scale. And for those of you who went to the talk by Steve Weinberg this morning, he has been discussing that at length. And here, one issue is, for instance, can we make sense of a theory, of a quantum field theory below the Planck scale out of something which is defined at the scale of the Planck mass? Okay? So in order to compute this, we, in fact, the idea is to start from a functional integral, so a path integral, with some action. So I start with an action, which is like that. And the question is not compute this starting from a given action, but the question is there an action such that those objects exist? Okay. Is there an action? So is there an action S of phi here such that these objects, the green functions of the theory, hence, for instance, the S matrix element, etc., exists.
You mean is finite?
Exist means that it's finite, that we, at the end of the calculation, we get something which is finite. You get matrix elements of operators between states, which are all finite and which satisfies the axiom of a quantum field theory. So they respect, for instance, causality, which is something important. They respect positivity, the fact that unitarity, so that the probabilities you compute by applying the rules of quantum mechanics to these objects are always positive. That's what you want. And so we have seen that, in fact, if we start from an action which is of the form, I would write it S0, because simply this will be the first, this will be the classical action, or let us call this a classical action. Classical action of the form before x, 1/2 of e mu phi squared plus root over 5/4. Here I have switched back to the Euclidean time for simplicity. And I want a theory which is massless. So I want a theory which is massless for simplicity. Okay. If I start from the classical action for a massless interacting theory for a scalar field, we have seen that it doesn't work, and that S has to be equal to S of phi, in order to have a massless theory, has to be the sum of a classical action, phi, plus something that I will call a new term, which is of order h bar in the coupling constant. So it's a quantum correction, and it's called a counter term. And we have seen that in order for the theory to be massless, delta 1 of S of phi has to be taken to be, it has to be a local term. It has to be proportional to the operator phi squared, so it's a mass counter terms. And there is a coefficient, and let me call this coefficient for simplicity B1. Okay? And this coefficient B1, we have found that it has to be equal to minus the coupling constant, h bar divided by 2. There is an h bar because I'm expanding in h bar. And times something which is divergent, which is in fact the amplitude of the tadpole propagator for the massless theory. So what does this represent? This Feynman diagrams represent the amplitudes of the tadpole. So it represents this integral, d4k over 2 pi squared, 1 over k squared, since I am computing it in the massless theory, and with a regulator, so that I take a sharp regulator, so I assume that k is less than lambda, and in that case, what you find that this coefficient is 1 over 32 pi squared times lambda squared. But the important fact is that it's proportional to lambda squared, because lambda squared is the only scale you have in the theory. So in this theory, I'm trying to construct a theory which is massless. The coupling constant is dimensionless. And therefore, the only mass counter term you can build has to be proportional to lambda squared. You see? And the coefficient here results for the calculation. But this depends on this coefficient I explained depends on the cutoff, depends on the kind of regulator you use. So if you were, for instance, considering the theory on lattice, replacing space-time by grid, the coefficient would be different. But it depends because okay. So now, in that case, we have seen that with this quantity, what is the two-point function of the theory was found to be just p squared. So the two-point function of the theory was, in fact, if you compute with this action, the irreducible two-point function of the theory, which is simply the sum over all diagrams irreducible and amputated of the theory. If you take its Fourier transform, because it's simpler to compute, you find that what it is p squared. That's the leading order given by perturbation theory. Then you have this factor g h bar over 2 times this diagram, which is that's the first order of perturbation theory, but then you have to add the counter term plus B1. And the counter term is adjusted so that this is P squared. And hence you have a finite two point function, which is a two point function of a massless field.
What's that symbol?
Pardon? Which one?
The negative circle?
This irreducible circle?
Oh,
okay. It just means the sum of all the irreducible diagrams.
Before.
Okay? Okay. So now, we shall turn to the most interesting part of the aspects of renormalization theory, which is do we need to renormalize also the coupling constant? So we shall be interested now into the four-point irreducible function, which means the term of order four in phi in the effective potential the effective action of the theory. Okay, and because we have seen that in fact this four-point irreducible function is also infinite, has also some singular term. So I remind you that the in impulsion space, the irreducible four-point function is simply given by the sum over all four-point irreducible diagram with incoming amplitudes P1, P2, P3, P4. That, so it's a sum of this diagram with those amplitudes coming through the computed leg. So it's related to the S-matrix element with two particles incoming and two particles outcoming, for instance. And it is given by, so there is first of 2 pi 4 delta 4 of sum of the impulsions that I won't care about that. And the interesting part is that it is given by a term which is the term of order G that I represent it by this diagram. So this diagram is just the vertex of the phi 4 theory, and it's proportional to G, because the term is in the action is G times phi to the 4. And then we have a term of order G squared, h bar over 2. Okay, so that's the coefficient. And then you have a sum over 4 Feynman diagrams, the 4 amplitudes associated to the 4 diagrams with 2 legs and 1 loops, where to each leg can be attached P1 and P2 or P3 or P4. Okay, so this is a sum of 4 terms. And these terms, I can denote them by saying that to a diagram like that, you see, for instance, here, for instance, for this diagram, where this is 1 and 2, this diagram will be given by an integral, which is simply d4q over 2 pi squared, 1 over q squared, plus 1 over times p squared, p plus q squared. I will say, what is this impulsion, I of p. Okay, and p here can be taken as to be either p1 plus p2 for the first diagram, p1 plus p3, or p1 plus p4. So you have 4 choices of incoming momentum in this bubble, in this diagram, and this corresponds to the 4 contributions to this amplitude given by applying the Vick theorem.
Why is it 4?
Pardon? P1 plus P2, P1 plus P3, or P1 plus P4.
So 3 choices.
You have 3 choices, yes. Did I say 4?
You're saying 4.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's 3 choices. 3 diagrams here. Okay, so you have 3 choices, and but everywhere you have the same function. Okay, and in fact, this corresponds in the language of collision theory in high energy physics to what is called the S, the T, and the U channel when you are considering amplitude. So, now, what is this diagram? So you have now you can expect that this diagram, this amplitude, is also ultraviolet divergence, but because there is an integral over the four components of the internal momenta, so you have an internal momenta which circulates in this loop, and simply there is a d4q divided by a term of order q4 when q is large. So if you compute this integral with the same rule that q has to be less than lambda, you expect to find a short distance and high energy divergent, but it will be logarithmic. So you expect to find something of order of log squared instead of having here something which is of order lambda squared. Okay, you do the calculation, you find that. Now you do the calculation a little bit more carefully, and you find that there is a coefficient in front of this integral, of this log, and the coefficient is 1 over 4 pi squared. And that's the result of the calculation. And this coefficient now, there is an important difference between the case of this integral and the case of this integral. This coefficient is universal. Okay. It's universal because it doesn't depend on the regulator, the kind of regulator you choose. And that's simply because this is logarithmic divergence. So instead of saying, of choosing that Q is less than Q than lambda, you choose that Q is less than 2 lambda, the coefficient here changes, but the coefficient in front of the log doesn't change. Because log of 2 lambda squared is log lambda squared plus log of 4. So the most singular term, which is the logarithm of lambda, doesn't change. And that's the reason why this coefficient is universal. So independent of the regulator used. Computed on a space-time which is replaced by a lattice, you will have the same term. Okay. But now we have a problem because the logarithm of this is a mass scale. And the logarithm of a mass doesn't exist. So it must be the logarithm of this lambda squared divided by something else, which is also as a dimension of a mass. But what do we have in the original term? We have only one mass scale at our disposal, which is p squared. Okay. So if you do the calculation a little bit carefully, the most divergent term has to be of this form. You see? Because, and you can check that, in fact, now if you work a little bit more carefully, you find that the subleading terms are always terms of, or there are subleading terms, but they are very, very small when the regulator is very large. Okay, so this is the value of this amplitude of this graph when p squared, when the regulator goes to zero. Okay. But you see also now something important. You see that the most divergent term is just the log. And so the log is independent of p squared. So the divergence here, the divergence when lambda goes to infinity is independent of p, the vector p here. So it's independent on the external momenta of the four-point function we are computing, you see? And therefore, in fact, the most divergent term is proportional to the term, the classical term. Yes?
Could you repeat why the divergence is independent of p?
Because it's a log. Log of 1 over p squared is finite. It's not a divergent term. The divergent term is logarithm of lambda space. The value of this amplitude depends on p squared. Fortunately, because otherwise there would be no, the physics of the model would be trivial. The value of this amplitude depends on p squared, but the divergence doesn't depend on p squared. Yes?
Why does that imply that the vertex is more divergent than the, I don't know what you want to call it, like envelope diagrams you've got there?
What do you mean by the vertex is more divergent?
Well, wasn't that you said that you pointed and said that that means that that's...
No, no, I meant that the first term is the perturbative expansion is obviously independent of the momentum.
Right.
This is a classical term. Yeah. Which comes from the G phi in the action. And it's independent of the momentum because the Fourier transform of phi 4 is just, of 1, is just the delta function. Okay, so interaction here is local. It doesn't depend on the speed, on the velocity, the energy of the bosons. The interaction term here depends on the energy of the bosons, their impulsions. But the classical term, interaction doesn't depend. Okay. But the most, the term which is divergent doesn't depend either of the external momenta, except for this trivial conservation of momenta. So you see that we expect that we can apply the same trick. We expect that If we had a counter term in the action, which will be proportional to a term of order phi squared, then we can get rid of this log. So this means that can be cured by adding a new counter term proportional to the operator phi 4. OK, and well, let me write it here, so I will erase that. So B1, here I wrote B1 is equal to minus G h bar over 2 times this diagram. So this means that in order to get rid of this singularity, this divergence, I will add a new counter term, which is, so let me note it, C1 times phi to the 4. And why should I choose for value for the counter term C1? Well, I should choose something which subtracts this term. So I should take that C1 is h bar g squared 1/2. You have 3 diagrams which contribute with the same divergence. So I have a factor of 3 coming from the fact that I have 3 diagrams. And then this logarithm of lambda squared. And this will make the theory finite because the four-point function will be finite too. Okay? So now I have not only a mass renormalization, but a coupling constant renormalization. You see? Okay. So you need to introduce a counter term, so to change the action here, so that it contains also a new term proportional to phi 4. It's required in order to obtain a theory which gives you finite Green functions and finite amplitudes. Okay? Now, now we still have a problem. Here, when we were studying how the four-point function associated to this diagram was diverging, we had a mass scale to divide, which was provided by the external momenta. But now we want that the counter term doesn't depend on the external momenta. Because having a counter term which depends on the external momenta would mean not having a counter term proportional to the local operator phi 4, but to a non-local operator, a complicated non-local interaction. And non-local interaction usually give you a lot of problems with causality, because the non-local interactions are not causal. Okay? So we want this to be completely independent on P, on the external momenta. Okay. So if we have no external momenta, but we still want to have something which is finite, we have no choice. We must introduce a new mass scale in order for this field. So let us introduce a new mass scale. And I will see new mass scale, mu, which is called the renormalization scale. Okay? And I will explain now what this mass scale means, so you see. And that's a very important difference with the renormalization of the mass. In the case of the renormalization of the mass, we had to introduce a counter term which was proportional to the phi squared, so counter term proportional to mass. And we had a mass in the theory, which was the regulator itself. Here we don't have Once we have a log, we have no choice. So we must introduce a new mass. Yes?
If we have gone up to higher order,
yes? Yes? Not as long as we keep considering the massless theory.
Right.
Because the massless theory have no physical mass from the, that I can impose from the renormalized theory I want to construct. What I'm going to construct is, here is what is called the renormalized theory. So as long as I try to construct the renormalized theory which is massless, I don't have this problem at any order for this counterterm. But I will always have this problem for renormalizing the mass. Because the coupling constant, because the singularities in the coupling constant expansion are proportional to logarithm, and therefore you must produce this mass renormalization scheme. Okay? See? Okay. And once you have done that, you are done because the four-point function is now finite. And what is what is this function now? The four-point function, let us type it here. What is the theory with the constant? What is the four-point function? The four-point function is now E highs is now, so there is this 2 pi d delta d of sub E I. And then what do I have? I have g plus minus g h square h bar over 2 times the sum of those three amplitudes. At each amplitude, I subtract the logarithm of lambda. I subtract this term. So I have something which I will call sum over the three choices of three choices of p equal p1 plus p2, p1 plus p3, or p1 plus p4. Of instead of having this this function, I will have something which I call I renormalized of p. Okay, and what is I renormalized of p? This is simply 1 over 4 pi squared logarithm of p squared, 1 over p squared multiplied by mu squared. Okay, because the logarithm of lambda squared plus p squared plus the logarithm, minus the logarithm of lambda squared divided by mu squared is the logarithm of mu squared divided by p squared. Remember that here there is a minus sign, and here there is no minus. And this is finite. See, this is finite in the limit lambda goes to infinity, but this depends also on mu, because this is a function of p over mu. Okay. So now, yes.
P is not a good scale to introduce of the counterterm.
Because if I introduce P, this would mean that I will introduce here a counterterm which depends on the momenta entering the four-point function. But the momenta entering in the four-point function, remember, are just the momenta which enter when I am writing that phi 4 as phi of p1, phi of p2, phi hat of p3, phi hat of p4 times the sum, delta function of the sum of tbi. This is the Fourier transform of phi 4 bits. As soon as I replace this by some more complicated function of the p's, this will become an object which is non-local. will be some phi smeared out. So it will become non-local. So if phi, it's become non-local. And non-local means problem with causality. N or beta. You see? Okay, so now, what is the meaning of this, what is the meaning of this, of this renormalization? I will, okay, I will erase that and I will discuss that later on. Okay. So what is the meaning of the introduction of this new mass scale? So what, why do we have to introduce a new mass scale in order to define a renormalized theory? Well, that's quite easy to understand on this expression. This 4 point, okay, this is the expression at one loop order, so at order g squared or at order h bar of the 4 point irreducible function. And this 4 point irreducible function is related, and in fact, in that case, is equal, so this 4 point function, which represents like that, irreducible, with some incoming and outgoing momenta, is related to the 2 plus 2 particle element of the S matrix. So it's related to some diffusion amplitudes on some physical process. So it's related really to a physical process you are measuring when you are doing collision about particles in an accelerator, not on this simple theory, which doesn't correspond to a physical model, but it's in general related to objects you can measure in your laboratory. Okay? And remember that, so this object depends on the momenta of the incoming and outgoing particles. And that's well known that in general, you know, diffusion amplitudes, collision amplitudes, depends on the momenta, okay? And now, see what's happening when the, so you see that there is one particular point where something happens. Imagine that you are a point where p squared is equal to mu squared. So I remember that the p squared are p1 plus p2, p1 plus p3, and p1 plus p4, okay? And imagine that you choose your amplitudes so that this, equals this, equal mu. So you choose a particular collision process where the impulsion of the ingoing and the outgoing particles satisfy this kind of identity. They do not need to satisfy it exactly, but that's a simple choice. In that case, this is the logarithm of 1. So you have three terms which are all equal to 1. So in that case, what you found is that for this choice of momenta, for the external particles, ingoing and outgoing particles, then the 4 point function, the PI, is just equal to the coupling constant which appears here and here, because the two root terms disappear, you see. There are some particular value of the momenta where the one loop term gives 0. It's a complicated function of the P's, but for some values of the P's, this term is equal to 0. You see? And for those particular values of the P's, this amplitudes is equal to the coupling constant. But you see that this amplitude is equal to the coupling constant only for some particular choice of the momentum. You see? And therefore, you can, in fact, inverse the way you view it. Imagine that you are considering a system. You have a system of particles. And in order to study the interaction of the particles, you are making experiments, collision experiments. And you measure what is the strength of the interaction, so the coupling constant, extracting it from collision experiments. Okay? And one way to define what is the coupling constant of the theory is to state that I define the coupling constant as the value of this four-point function for some process. And you see that with such a definition, the value of the coupling constant depends on the momenta. Okay? And therefore, if you choose to perform the momenta, the experiment at momenta, which are equal to mu, or are equal to mu, 2 mu, or 3 mu, or 4 mu, you will get a different result. So you will get something that you call the coupling constant, which will be different. You see? So this is a way I define the coupling constant. And the coupling constant in such a process is defined always with reference to some momentum or mass or energy scale. You see? And yes? Pardon? I divide by the delta. Well, here I am doing a collision process. So I assume that the moments are conserved, energy conserved. So I divide by this term. So this would be gamma hat. So let us, if you prefer, gamma hat is. First, you must be on shell, and second, you can subtract. You can subtract both, and then you get it. Okay. Okay. So the important thing is to realize that in such a calculation, when you try to define what is the coupling constant of the theory, it's always a reference to some energy scale. Yes.
So, given that we started with the massless theory, and we want to continue, we could rescale the mass, but if we want to keep the massless theory. We can
but here it's important because we are always dealing with a massless. Here I started from the massless theory. Okay. And that's important. Because in a massless theory, you have no scale at your disposal.
Yes.
Okay? And it's important to remember to realize that in fact all if you have masses in a quantum particle with masses, those masses are always very, very small compared to, for instance, the Planck mass. Because we are completely unable to realize collisions between black holes. Okay, so you must realize that in fact quantum field theory must always be considered as a perturbation of a theory with massless particles. Then after that you can have a little bit switch on the mass. But
can you renormalize a massless theory with zero mass into a theory with mass?
No, you have to, in order to have a theory with a mass, you will introduce another parameter of the theory that you call the mass. But in fact, you can view the mass as a new coupling constant, a dimensionful coupling constant, but a coupling constant. Okay. So for the moment, all I am saying here is strictly true for a massless theory. But I have good reason to explain why I'm skipping in the framework of a massless theory. First, because it's easier, and second, because it's physical, because in fact, the masses are always small compared to the regulator, the Planck scale.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So we have no mass scale available to define what is the coupling constant? So we must choose a mass scale. Yes?
Does this mean that the coupling constant is scaled, is energy scale dependent?
Yes, exactly. You got the right point.
My question is that, is this a direct result of Lorentz invariance?
No. It's no, it's not. Well, in some sense, we have been doing the calculation always expecting scale invariance. So it's part of the game. But in fact, such renormalization effects appears also in non-relativistic particles. In condensed matter. Condensed matter is full of renormalization effects. The mass of the electron in a conductor is renormalized compared to its mass in the vacuum because it interacts with the phonon in the crystal and with other electrons. So those renormalization effects are everywhere, also in non-relativistic systems.
What I meant is that we define the coupling constant to be scale dependent.
Yes.
For the cutoff scale not to be observable.
To the
That's correct. We want mu to be not. We want mu to be not an observable. We want the physical results to be independent of mu. Am I right to say that?
No. No. Yes. We want the physical. If you start from a theory. You know, we have renormalized it in some way. So now G is fixed, mu is fixed, and this is a function of P. Okay? And I will discuss in a few minutes what does it mean to change the definition of the scalar by which you are concerned. But now I have a theory. I have just given you a device to construct a finite irreducible function out of a quantum theory. And those finite irreducible function, here I have defined them in terms of some parameter. One parameter is g, and one parameter is mu. But in fact, g is defined as the value of this irreducible function for some particular choice of the p's. This object is defined. This is defined for this function gamma of p is defined for a given physical theory. Okay, and for a given physical theory, I'm sorry, it's not very visible. I'm sorry. For a given physical theory, you know, I define what is the coupling constant with reference to measurement at some energy scale. You see? Okay? Okay? Yes?
What do you do with the action? Like, you've derived an effective field theory from an underlying action, which yes. goes to infinity and can
yes.
limit.
Yes.
Well, what do you do with
the Well, the problem is that the only important thing is the effective action, because the effective action is related to the quantity you are observing.
Yeah, but undoubtedly, you could put energy scales past the effective, where the effective field theory breaks down and the underlying action becomes a
Well, this I will discuss that later. I prefer to postpone this discussion a bit later at the end of the lecture. But I will reflect, answer to your question. Okay. So now we have two quantities. We have a quantity which depends, we have a theory which depends on two things. There is a mass which is always equal to zero. So the mass has been fixed to zero, and I will call it the renormalized mass. Okay? And I have a coupling constant, G, which I call GR, which is, I will call the renormalized coupling constant. Okay? But this coupling constant is defined with respect to an energy scale. Okay. And once we have done that, you have a theory which is ultraviolet finite. So I won't discuss this aspect, but in fact, you can show that there are no other ultraviolet divergences at one loop. No other additional ultraviolet singularities h bar, namely at order of one loop. Okay, because the next diagram is a triangle diagram, and this triangle diagram is ultraviolet finite. So once we have renormalized both the mass in order to have a physical mass, which is zero, and the Kubrick constant in order to have a renormalized Kubrick constant finite, we end up with a theory whose all amplitudes are ultraviolet finite at order h bar. So the first quantum correction to all the quantities you can compute and measure in the theory are ultraviolet finite. Okay?
Any other one-loop diagram
would be ultraviolet
finite as well?
Any other?
One loop.
Yes, yes, because they are, this is the first one-loop diagram, but then this is a one-loop diagram with eight legs, and this is also ultraviolet finite.
How do you finite, so, just upon inspection?
Well, they are finite for the following reason. They are finite simply because if you count their degrees in terms of integration over internal momenta, you see, basically these amplitudes will be something like you will have a momenta q going through this loop, and you have something like b for q, and then you have three propagators. And this, when q, of course, you have. Calculating this in a theory where q is less than lambda, but when lambda goes to infinity, this integral is converged. Okay. So what you must remember, because that's one of the most important aspects in quantum field theory, is that because of the fact that you must take into account the high energy behavior of the theory, the Kubrick constant of the theory are always defined with reference to some energy scale. And now, let us apply that to what we were doing. Let us consider the same, so I will be considering the same theory, in the same theory, namely with the same observable, namely the same green functions, the same effective action. So I consider a given theory that I've constructed in that way, and I want to consider what is the value of the coupling constant defined with a reference to the to the scale? So I want to, my question is, how does the renormalized coupling constant depends on the energy scale at which it is measured? So I made a collision experiment with particles which have an energy of 1 electron volt. And from that, I deduce one value for the coupling constant. Now I made the same experiment with the same particle, but with particle with an energy of 1 mega electron volt. And from that I extract another value of the Kubrick constant, and it turns out from this result that it's not the same, because it depends on, so I choose here P to be equal to, here I have some mu, but here I have a P which is equal to 1 electron volt square, or 10 to the power 3. Square or 10 to the power 6 squared, etc. So now, so how does this Renormalized coupling that I will call this G effective of mu. How does it depend? What is the condition on this coupling constant? Well, it's very simple. It's simply that take the formula. I defined G to be the here I have defined G to be the value of the coupling constant which appears here in my calculation for p equal some. So I will I will show this energy scale. I will call it. I start from a theory which is defined. So in this theory is defined in my calculation. I have renormalized the theory with renormalization scale that I shall call mu zero. And in this with this renormalization scale mu zero, the coupling constant is equal to G zero. Okay, so I measure gamma four of P for P equal mu naught, and I get G naught. Okay? And now I measure the coupling constant G at some other scale mu, different from mu zero. So for if mu is different from mu zero, what I measure is a coupling constant G of mu. You see, which is different from mu from G zero, because the coupling because the value of the four point function depends on the momentum. Okay. So what is the relation between G mu and G naught? Well, that's easy because we have computed here everything. So the relation between G mu and G naught is simply that G of mu minus G of mu squared h bar over 2 times 3 over 4 pi squared times logarithm of mu squared has to be equal to G naught minus G naught squared h bar over 2 times 3 over 4 pi squared logarithm of mu 0 squared. Okay, that's the relation, because the simple relation between those, the value of the coupling constant here and the value of the coupling constant here. Okay? And what is called g of mu is what is called the running coupling constant. Okay, and it's just the this means that it's simply the coupling constant measured as at the energy scale mu, which depend on this energy scale mu simply because it's related to the value of some irreducible function or some collision amplitudes at a given energy scale. Okay, and this is the relation between G of mu and the way we have defined the coupling constant at the origin in the theory with respect to a fixed renormalization scale. Okay? And so, and you see from this formula, obviously, that when you vary mu, G must vary in order for this to remain constant. Okay? So now, there is a nice way to write the mu dependence of G, because since this depends continuously of mu, what you must write, in fact, is a differential equation. So write a differential equation, for G of mu. Okay, and this differential equation is called, define what is called the beta function for the coupling constant. And that's a kind of differential equation which was first considered in the framework of quantum electrodynamics by Gell-Mann and Lowe. Gell-Mann and Lowe in the context of quantum electrodynamics, because there is exactly the same phenomena of renormalization in quantum electrodynamics, and it's in fact the framework of quantum electrodynamics that the whole theory of renormalization and of this this scale dependence of the coupling constant has been discovered. Okay. So let us defined very simply. So instead of writing how this equation explicitly, let us define simply how g of mu, the running coupling constant, scales with the logarithm of mu. So let us write mu d of d mu of g of mu. Okay? And this, by definition, is a function of g of mu, which is called the beta function of g of mu. This is the beta function. And I've write it as beta with an index which is g, simply because it's a beta function which tells you how the coupling constant g varies with respect to the logarithm of the scale. So in a theory where when you have several coupling constants, you have one beta function for every coupling constant. So this is the beta function for the coupling G. Okay. And now, well, it's easy. Compute this for this formula, and you end up with a very simple result, which is that this is G squared 3 over 16 pi squared. And if you do the calculation, and this is the beta function for the phi 4 theory. Okay? And this coefficient, of course, is related to the divergence in the diagram we were studying at the beginning. It's related to this diagram. So this coefficient, you will find the same coefficient whichever renormalization procedure you are considering. So this coefficient is universal, independent of the normalization scheme chosen. Okay.
Where does mu win? Oh, never mind. I'm the left hand side.
Okay. I should have written an h bar if I want really to follow my notation where I bought both h bar. G note, there is an h bar because so this indicates that this is the result, the contribution of the one loop quantum effects. Okay. And in fact, of course, if you continue to study the theory at higher orders, you will discover that there are higher order corrections. These beta functions, which are given by term of order h bar squared times g cubed, etc. In fact, there are higher loop corrections. Beta function. Okay. Yes?
So when you calculate the beta function for more loops, does it always keep the asymptotic behavior be the same?
It always keeps the asymptotic behavior of this.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. This term won't change when you compute higher loop contribution.
No, but what I mean is, so like in the limit as mu goes to infinity, the solution G goes to something. So
okay, yes, that I'm going to do. This is a calculation I'm doing basically, for instance, in order to get such an equation, you consider that mu is close to mu zero, to mu naught, and you make a small variation. And then now I have explored this information to see what's happening when mu becomes very large or very small. Yes?
What about extending the effect fraction to terms like an h squared and trying to compute corrections then for loop? new corrections. Can you do that?
That's what I, yes, yes, yes. That's why I stated that it's possible. And when you compute them, you find corrections. But in order to compute higher correction, you have, for instance, to compute contribution diagram like that. This is a diagram which contributes to the four-point function. It's a two-loop diagram. It's non-trivial to compute, and it could give a contribution of order g to the power of 3, because there are 3 vertices. So, but there is a systematic, and in fact, it took, I think, 15 or 20 years to physicists and mathematicians to give a rigorous proof that it's possible at all order in perturbation theory. Yes?
So if you work out what happens to G as mu goes to infinity at 1,
yes,
and you see that maybe it goes to infinity or something, when you compute the beta function of the higher orders in H bar,
yes,
will it always keep the same asymptotic dependence?
Yes, yes. Okay. I will come to that. Wait a few minutes. Okay. So this is the equation which tells you how the running Couplet constant vary with the energy scale. Okay? And you see that for the 5-4 theory, the sign here is positive. So the beta function, the sign of the one loop of the beta function is positive for 5-4. Here we go. And in fact, it turns out that it's also true for quantum electrodynamics. And we see what are the consequences of this fact. So immediately, what does it mean? The fact that it's positive means that if mu gets larger, the running Couplet constant increases. So at high energy, the Couplet constant is larger, and at small energy, the Couplet constant is smaller. So high energies of mu increase, and low energy G of mu decrease. Okay, so the couplings between bosons becomes important the more energetic the bosons are, and the coupling becomes small the less energetic the bosons are. And this phenomenon is called infrared asymptotic freedom. Asymptotic freedom means that in some asymptotic domain, the theory becomes a free theory because the Couplet constant becomes very, very small. See? And here, the theory is asymptotically free in the infrared because it's asymptotically free at low energy. In high energy, the bosons are more coupled. So it's all often referred to the fact that the theory has asymptotic slavery. Because the opposite of freedom is slavery. In the case of 5-4, that's not really true, because remember, we have this theory describes contact interaction between bosons, and the interaction is repulsive. You see? So, the higher the energy, the more repelled the bosons are repelled. So they are not really slaves. But here they are independent, and here they repel each other. Yet they cannot get a buzzy and stay together. They are not free to stay together. They cannot choose not to be together. While in the infrared, they can do what they want. So in that sense, it's the opposite. Here you have choice, here you have no choice. Okay? But if a theory has attractive forces, this means that the more energetic the particles are, the more attractive they are. Okay? So, with this, let us see what's happening for us now integrate this calculation, this this differential equation at first order. If I integrate, this is a differential equation. Okay, remember this is g of mu. So I can integrate this differential equation, integrate. What do we found? We found that g of mu is equal to g naught. Remember that g naught was just the value of the Copley constant at the scale energy mu naught. And you find 1 minus g naught, 3 over 16 pi squared times logarithm of mu over mu naught. Okay? So this is the solution of this differential equation. And you see that indeed, if mu is larger than mu naught, this is positive. So this is smaller than 1. So the Copley constant is larger than g naught. Okay, so I can write how it's happening. So as a function of logarithm of mu, g of mu is increasing. You see? Okay. Now you to reply to answer your question. You see that when I'm doing that, in fact, I am resuming a lot of contribution because if I develop the equation, I find that g of mu is g naught plus g naught squared times the log plus g naught to the power 3 times log squared. This is, in fact, g naught plus g naught squared, this coefficient log, plus g naught to the power 3 times this some coefficient log squared of mu plus, et cetera. You see? So in fact, in this equation are contained the contribution of 2-loop diagrams, 3-loop diagrams, 4-loop diagrams. This series, in fact, contains the contribution of higher loop diagrams. And one of the, in fact, one of the aim of the, and the beauty of randomization theory, and you can show that indeed this, the solution of this equation contains the dominant term of coming from higher loop diagrams, in fact. And basically what happens is that, for instance, I show you that, for instance, I was considering this diagram, then you have this diagram, but then you can consider a diagram like that, for instance. Let us consider a diagram like that. Then I have this diagram. Okay, then I consider this diagram. Okay. You see, this is a one-loop diagram. This is a two-loop diagram obtained by inserting a bubble inside a vertex. Now, this is a three-loop diagram where I insert a vertex inside this bubble, and I go on, I go on. Okay? And that's a subclass of all the possible higher-loop diagrams. The contribution in the randomization group equation of these diagrams is contained in this.
There should be an h-bar.
There is, of course, an h-bar. Yes. Yes?
What happens at the pole?
Yes, very good question. Of course, there is a pole here. So let me write this. Okay. There is a pole. And the pole happens when mu is equal to mu zero times exponential of 17 pi squared over 3 g naught. Okay. At this point, g of mu becomes infinite. And this means that perturbation theory breaks down. But all the calculation we have been doing, does that make sense? Okay? And it's a problem which has been noticed for QED by Landau, so very early in the history of quantum electrodynamics, as soon as the first calculation of the of randomization and the concept of running complete constant appeared. And it's, so this pole is called the Landau pole. And it means that there is a problem for QED at this point, which I call the Landau L. Okay? So there is a problem with the perturbation theory. For QED, it's not much of a problem because remember that for QED, G naught has to be replaced by E squared, so it's a fine structure constant. So basically, you have the exponential of 137, well, we have some factor of pi, but you have an exponential of a large number. So this, the point where there is a Landau pole is very, very high, and I think it's beyond the Planck scale. So it's not really a problem. It's not really a problem for QED, but it's a problem for the X sector of the standard model. It's a problem for, it may be a problem for the X sector of the standard model, because the X sector of the standard model is also described by a 5-4 theory. It's a complex field, but it has more degrees of freedom. And the fact that perturbation theory breaks down means that you expect that you have problem with unitarity, amongst other things. And therefore, for the X sector, this kind of problems puts constraint on the mass of the X, because the mass of the X is related to the value of the coupling constant between the Higgs and the other particles. So it, the value of some coupling constant is reflected in the mass of the X. And for some models of the standard model, you get problem with unitarity beyond a domain where the sector is described by more particles. So in fact, you see, it put constraint on the mass of the X, for instance. Okay? Okay, so now, finally, but fortunately, of course, and I think you have heard that about that, for gauge theories, non-abelian gauge theories like QCD, the beta function is negative. So instead of having infrared freedom and ultraviolet slavery, you have ultraviolet freedom, high energy, you have ultraviolet asymptotic freedom, so you have asymptotic freedom at short distance. The quarks and the gluons are weakly coupled at high energy, but you have infrared slavery, so therefore they are strongly coupled at high energy. But in that case, this problem is not really a problem. The coupling constant becomes very large, but this thing has the amount of the occurrence of non-perturbative effects. So for instance, this mass scales doesn't mean that QCD is not unitary at low energy. It means that non-perturbative phenomena, like typically confinement, occur at this energy scale.
So why can't we say that for the scalar field theory, that there are some non-perturbative phenomena?
There might be, but this would mean that there would be an ultraviolet safe fixed point somewhere. For those of you who went to the talk by Steve Weinberg, in order to cure this problem of a Landau pole, the only solution people have found up to now, well, there are two solutions. Either the theory is embedded in a bigger theory, and therefore the beta function changes, or it becomes a non-local theory, like string theory, for instance. Either there is an ultraviolet fixed point which controls that. And people have been looking for many, many years whether there was a non-trivial ultraviolet fixed point in the 5-4 theory. Some people still believe that there is one, but there has been no convincing evidence ever, even based on numerical calculation, that there is anything such as a fixed point. So it seems that the problem is real. Okay, so perhaps I think I would just want to say a word about the signification, and then the lecture will end. But I would want to end with an important concept. What does this mean that there is a running coupling constant? Let us say that. What does it mean that the beta function, there is a beta function which is different from zero, and therefore there are running something constant. It's related to some very, very important properties of quantum field theory, which is how scale invariance behaves in the theory. So let us consider the action S of phi, the classical action for the massless phi to the 4 theory. We are in four dimensions, and therefore it has a very, very important property, which is that if you take any field configuration and you change it by what is called a scale transformation, which consists in multiplying the function by lambda and changing, dividing by lambda the position. So this means that you take a, you start from a field configuration here, and what you are doing is that you are contracting the space, and you are expanding the value of the field. So you are transforming this function in something like that. Expand, contract, expand. This is phi, this is x. This is phi lambda, this is x. And it's an easy calculation to show that the action of phi lambda is equal to the action of phi for any phi. You see? This means that the massless phi 4, massless phi 4, is scaling line. You may look at the solution of the equation of motion of this complicated nonlinear theory. You make a scale transformation, you obtain another solution for the same value of g. You see? So massless phi 4 is scaling line. What does it mean that the coupling constant is running with a scale? It depends that, in fact, the coupling constant changes with the scale, and it means that, in fact, therefore, that the scale invariance is anomalous. It's anomalous means that it is broken by quantum effects. Okay? Pardon? Because of renormalization. But renormalization is a way to construct a theory. But once you have constructed the theory, you found that in this theory, scale invariance is anomalous. Okay? And there is another interpretation of the beta function. You know, if you have a symmetry in a field theory or in any classical theory, if you have a symmetry, you have a conserved current. This is Noether theorem. I think you have seen it. Okay. So, you know, for instance, translation invariance, there is a current which is an energy momentum tensor. So, if a theory is scale invariant, there is a current, the current G mu of X, associated to scale transformation. Okay? If this symmetry, this current is conserved. So the divergence of the current must be equal to zero. Classically, it is equal to zero. And you can compute. An exercise is to compute what is the current associated to scale invariance for this classical theory, applying the Noether theorem. Now, in the quantum theory, compute this theorem, and what you found that there is a term which is of order h bar. It's proportional to the operator phi to the 4 of x. And this operator has the same dimension as the current. And what is the coefficient in front of this operator? This is the beta function associated to the coupling constant. Okay, there is perhaps a minus sign, I don't remember. So you have an interpretation of the beta function. One interpretation is how the running complete constant varies with the scale. Another interpretation, equivalent, is that it's the coefficient of the scale anomaly. Okay? And we shall discuss probably some other anomalies in the context of quantum field theory. But it's very important to remember that for, in general, for any theory which is scale invariant at the classical level, when you quantize it, in general, scale invariance is broken by quantum effects, and therefore it's anomalous. It doesn't mean that the theory is inconsistent. It means simply that some of its classical properties are changed by quantum effects. In some sense, it means that the quantum theory is more interesting than the classical theory, if you want. Okay, so thank you.
Just have a question.